about to hear was delivered by Major William E. Mayer, United States Army Medical Corps. Major Mayer is a psychiatrist, presently teaching at the Brook Army Medical Service School. He formerly was assigned to the Joint Armed Forces team detailed to study the behavior of American prisoners of war held by the communists in Korea. He has served as a medical officer in both Army and Navy, and was overseas in World War II and in Korea. The title of this address is Brainwashing, Its Implication to America.
My subject is not entirely a specifically medical one, and yet we think it has great pertinence to physicians. It was undertaken from a medical point of view to begin with, but it has importance for physicians and for teachers and for everyone in the professions because of their enormously advantageous position in regard to working on the obvious solutions, or at least the solutions that seem to suggest themselves from the findings that have arisen from a study of Americans who've been held in communist hands. The study that this material was taken from was a joint one undertaken by all the services, and not only by the medical service within these services, but by other agencies as well. The material that I will report to you will, of course, not necessarily represent the final and official doctrine of the Department of Defense or of any official agency of the government, and will necessarily include, as does the speaking of any citizen in the armed forces, some of his own conclusions and those of the workers with whom I gathered this material. We think that it's important in the overall struggle of our ideas against an ideology sincerely and most admittedly directly opposed to ours, that we understand something about the methods and the attitudes and the aims of the communists. Now, everybody knows that communism is bad, and yet a great many people know very little about it. A great many people know that disturbing things happened in Korea, and most people have come to the conclusion that these things happened to our soldiers because they were subjected to some form of diabolical punishment, something they couldn't resist. And this, in reality, is a kind of defeatist attitude, a pernicious one, which, if it gains strong enough foothold, can be our undoing in itself. Now, in order to introduce my subject adequately, I'd like to read for you a communist document written in July 1951. It's in the form of a message, and the dateline on the message was one of the prisoner of war camps, camp number 5, in the city of Pyeongtaek, in what is called the People's Republic of North Korea. It's addressed to the Chief of Intelligence of the Chinese People's Republic in Peking, and originates from the Chief of Intelligence of the Chinese People's Volunteer Army in North Korea. The subject of this message: an estimate of American military personnel, meaning specifically an estimate of young Americans. The text reads as follows. Based upon observation of American soldiers and their officers captured in the war for the liberation of Korea from capitalist imperialist aggression, the following facts are evident. The American soldier has weak loyalties to his family, his community, his country, his religion, and to his fellow soldier. His concepts of right and wrong are hazy. Opportunism is easy for him. By himself, he feels frightened and insecure. He underestimates his own worth and his own strength and his ability to survive. He is largely ignorant of social values, social tensions, and conflicts. There is little knowledge or understanding, even among U.S. university graduates, of American political history and philosophy, the federal, state, and community organizations, states and civil rights, freedoms, safeguards, checks, and balances, and how these things supposedly operate within his own system. He is exceedingly insular and provincial, with little or no idea of the problems and the aims of what he contemptuously describes as foreigners and their countries. He has an unrealistic concept of America's eternal and inherent, rather than earned or proven, superiority and absolute military invincibility. This is his most vulnerable weakness. He fails to appreciate the meaning of and the necessity for military organization or any form of discipline. Most often, he feels that his military service is a kind of hateful, unavoidable servitude to be tolerated as briefly as possible and then escaped from as rapidly as possible. Or he is what they call a peacetime soldier who sees it only as a soft and a safe job. Both of these types in particular resent hardship and sacrifice of any description as if these things were unreasonable and unfair to them personally. Based upon the above facts about the imperialist United States aggressors, the re-education and indoctrination program for Americans proceeds as planned. That's the end of the message. Now, this was not actually taken from a single message. It was reconstructed from several enemy documents. And after an intensive and most exhaustive study of the methods and the attitudes of the Chinese in particular, as they reveal these things for the first time overtly in their handling of some 4,000 Americans in POW camps in Korea. For every single accusation in the foregoing message, there were accumulated a great many facts and concrete examples, both by the Chinese and then subsequently also by us. Now, this communication serves to illustrate one of the two major themes in the report you're about to hear, and perhaps for us here, by far the most important theme, namely those specific weaknesses and shortcomings which did become clear in Korea in our own military personnel, which in turn would appear to reflect certain weaknesses and shortcomings in this generation of Americans and in their parents and their teachers and their leaders. In that sense, then, this is not a medical paper, but a commentary on manners and morals, on character, and the lack of it. On a widespread disease, if you will, it might be considered the number one social disease of Americans. Now, we in the Army Medical Service feel it's properly our province to be concerned with this disease as with any other, but we're not the source of its cure. Its prevention, which is even more important, as well as its cure, are fundamental, we think, to the continuing survival of our system and are the duty and the responsibility primarily of every parent and teacher, as well as every non-com and officer and every social institution which goes to make up this nation. Now, my second major thesis is a description of something picturesquely called brainwashing. Now, this word is an astonishing achievement in psychological warfare by itself. It was invented by the Chinese. It has a highly specific meaning. It's a word that has entered our language fairly successfully and unfortunately is almost universally misused and misunderstood. We entered the study of returned prisoners from Korea with some fairly well-established ideas of our own as to what brainwashing was, and we're surprised to find that contrary to our belief, it wasn't a system of torture or punishment or degradation or brutality designed to destroy the will to resist of such unshakable people as Cardinal Minzenti. And this is where the confusion lies. People like Minzenti, like Otis and Vogeler, like some of the important original members of the Communist International, these people are ordinarily given a sort of individualized, solitary treatments with a number of pressures, usually even then not physical ones. And they're reduced, or so it would seem, to a kind of subhuman state where all they can do is, apparently, confess to whatever they're told to confess to and then proceed seemingly placidly to their execution or their exile. Now, that sort of thing is not new. It is also not brainwashing. Brainwashing is a device designed by no means to destroy men, but designed specifically to alter certain of their convictions and their principles wherever it's possible to do this, and mainly to supply them with a mass of specific, carefully planned and thought out educational information. It is, more than anything else, a process of education, and one methodologically of a very high order of excellence, combined with sound, tested, and perfectly familiar everyday principles of psychology and psychiatry. These principles, needless to say, are used in a somewhat different way than we're used to. They're certainly not applied in any attempt to reduce anxiety or to relieve the emotionally disturbed. They aren't, on the other hand, designed either to create insanity of some sort. They're designed to create a certain, very limited, specific, defined anxiety state, a state of confusion and fearfulness, falling far short of anything that could conceivably be called mental illness. The communist is no fool. He's running what amounts to an evangelical kind of religion. And for his evangelist today, he's evidently interested in people who are still able to think and communicate what they think and believe at least segments, important segments, of what he's trying to teach. He's no longer interested so much, it appears, in the automatons who just put out canned slogans from Moscow. Now, this very excellent educational system is and was designed specifically as a weapon in a very real and very current war, a war that's going on all over the world today. This war we are not spectacularly winning at the present time. Call it a war of ideas or a cold war or what you will. The fact remains that this weapon is a good one and an effective one, and it requires that we contrive defenses of a new kind against it. Against this weapon, we can't rely upon air defense radar systems and guided missiles and submarines that go around the world without coming up, or upon any material weapon or fortification. The fortifications on this battlefield must be moral and spiritual and psychological. Anything else is not only useless against an excellent weapon of the sort they've devised, but is daily becoming increasingly pointless. Now, like any weapon, this one has certain general characteristics which work in our favor. To begin with, like any other weapon, it can be looked into, taken apart, dissected, spread out on the table, understood. And this we've attempted to do, not by studying one man or a few individuals, but by attempting to study in some detail everybody who was exposed to the communist indoctrination or brainwashing or whatever you want to call it. And this is what I'd like to report to you tonight. Secondly, we can ordinarily, against this or any other weapon, once we understand it, contrive reasonably adequate defenses. Now, some months ago, toward the end of the summer, President Eisenhower outlined a new code of conduct for American fighting men, a seemingly almost naive document, and I'm sure that for those of you who've been in the military, it did strike you as a rather naive and obvious document. I'd like to comment upon this code a little bit after a while, but at least for the moment, it is an attempt at a defense. And properly applied and undertaken, it can go far, we think, in defending against the communist weapon. Well, finally, we can usually, when confronted with a weapon that works like this one does, one that we understand and that we can defend against, we can usually come up with something better. And we have something better. We have it, and yet we often don't sell it. And this is why we think it's important for people to understand just how dedicated and intense and sincere the communist world is in using their own set of ideas to win out. Now, very early in the study of the returned prisoners from Korea, it was believed, on the basis of one man who was studied, it was a typical scientific evaluation of a series of one case, and on the basis of this one case, a board was convened which came to certain conclusions about what happens to an American in the hands of communists who are undertaking this specialized kind of process. This board said, after studying one man who unfortunately was one of the less than 5% ever subjected to any specialized treatment, said that if any American, you, were subjected to communist indoctrination and brainwashing, one of three things, and only one of only these three, would inevitably happen. It was said that no one could resist very long without either becoming insane, which was their word, resisting the communists, or dying trying to resist it, or failing either of those alternatives, suffering what they called moral decay or a complete moral collapse and becoming, in a word, a communist. Well, our series now consists of somewhat more than one case, and our conclusions are markedly different. Examining the incidence of recognizable mental disorder, particularly of serious proportions, diagnosable conditions among the prisoners of war in Korea, we found that the incidence was no higher than it is at Fort Sam Houston or at Fort Hood or at Corpus Christi Naval Air Station or any other stateside military installation. This experience, then, evidently, very much like combat itself, does not produce serious, definable mental disease. We went then into the problem of men dying, resisting it. Very early in the repatriation, we encountered a number of stories of a lieutenant, a Texan, by the way, who had stood up to the Chinese during one of the marches, to the Koreans, rather, during one of the marches, and had been executed in front of about 500 witnesses. We had 500 separate stories about the execution of prisoners. When we correlated, it was all this one man. But there were other examples, obviously, of people who died unnecessarily or because of brutality. But they were so small in number that we were really startled by this. And in examining the more than 2 years of intensive indoctrination and brainwashing that were performed on the Americans in Korea, we find not one documented example of any man tortured to death or beaten to death or starved to death or executed by any means for resisting this intensive and prolonged indoctrination program. Well, we did find some rather unusual things when we studied these people that had been in communist hands, most of them for almost 3 years. They weren't the kind of things we'd expected. They weren't these things. But they were equally or more disturbing when we got to know them intimately. And naturally, we had to compare here our findings with the results of similar studies of repatriated prisoners of war in previous wars. An enormous body of information has been obtained about POWs in Japanese and German camps during World War II. We find in general that in spite of temporary lapses of organization and so on, in general, regardless of the severity of the conditions of military captivity, Americans have behaved more or less uniformly under this circumstance. For example, there's always been, among American prisoners, a kind of buddy system, a buddying up, which occurred, in which individuals relied fairly seriously and consistently on at least one other man for protection and for mutual support. This we found to be remarkably absent among the POWs coming back from Korea. These men came back acting almost in many cases as if they were strangers to the men that they just lived 3 years in a POW camp with. Secondly, we found that in the past there have always been, again, in spite of the severity of the conditions of capture, there have always been internal organizations among the prisoners which functioned with some degree of effectiveness. The outstanding such organizations have been escape committees, who not only assisted in escapes, but even selected the candidates for escape. No escape committees functioned effectively in Korea. There have always been military justice committees designed to ferret out those who collaborated or those who informed. No such military justice organization was set up in Korea. There has always been some semblance of military organization with committees or details assigned to such things as food, house repairing, camp sanitation, public health measures, and that sort of thing, communications. No such committees were established, and no committee of any of those types functioned at all effectively in Korea. Again, in the past, we've always seen a good deal of conspiratorial activity on the part of the prisoner. Now, this kind of conspiracy that I speak of is not a very profound undertaking ordinarily. A good example was a medical conspiracy in some of the camps in Japan. During that war, as you know, our only really effective antibiotic was the sulfa drugs, and some soldiers carried sulfa tablets or sulfa powder, especially Corman carried some of this, as that was then used to dust in wounds. And the Japanese knew about this medicine. It was certainly far superior to what they had, at least in the early stages of the war. And they were quite eager to get it. Now, with typical inconsistency, and the inconsistencies were very marked in Japanese POW camps, some of the very Japanese who were brutal and even participated in executions and beatings and spitting upon the prisoners and so on were strangely enough willing to pay in many cases for sulfa tablets or sulfa powder if any of the prisoners had it and was willing to sell it. And the prisoners in most cases, of course, didn't have it, or if they did, were unwilling to sell it. But there was some nice white plaster-type material available, and a number of prisoners conspired together and manufactured large quantities of plaster of Paris sulfa tablets, which they sold to the Japanese. Now, this didn't affect the war. The most it affected was some Japanese gastrointestinal tracts, but it did an important thing psychologically for the prisoner. One has to recognize that in this peculiarly deprived situation, which is productive of an enormous amount of continuing anxiety, his outlets, his possible psychological defenses are extremely limited. One of his most important defenses would be an aggressive act of any kind, however small. And the conspiracy serves this purpose more than any other one. It doesn't end wars, but it does keep prisoners alive and keeps them unified, keeps them feeling that they are engaged in some useful harassment, at least, of the enemy. We saw a spectacular example of this type of thing on Kojido and Jeju-do when the Chinese engaged, the Chinese POWs that we held, engaged not only in conspiracies, but managed to tie up practically an entire American division just to keep the camps quiet. Now, this is a profound military achievement. But this kind of activity didn't occur, evidently, among Americans in Korea, and this, too, led us to wonder and probe deeper for reasons. Well, we thought at first that the reasons possibly lay in the typical Oriental tortures and brutality that we'd learned to expect during World War II. We thought at least they must have worked them long hours in road gangs and coal mines and the kind of things that the Japanese and the Germans both did. And we found that there wasn't any of this. There wasn't any widespread physical abuse. There wasn't any forced labor. The diet, while it was poor by our standards, was certainly better than the Korean natives were getting. And the prisoners came home and told us this. So none of these were explanations. We had to go a little further, and we came up with some rather interesting things. To begin with, the average soldier in Korea in a bunker fighting an Oriental enemy whom he neither understood nor knew much about fully expected, on the basis of our American mythology, that if he were captured by this diabolical Oriental enemy, he would undoubtedly be subjected to some fiendish, exquisite Oriental torture. Everybody knows they put burning bamboo splinters under the fingernails. And this is the kind of thing that went on in the occasional but inevitable discussions among soldiers in combat of what happens to you if these people catch you. And it was quite widely accepted that the soldier's lot in the hands of this enemy would undoubtedly be beatings and probably torture, and most probably for most prisoners, death. It was quite a shock then when the soldiers who were conditioned in this way to expect this kind of treatment were met upon capture, particularly by the Chinese, were met upon capture not by beatings or brutality, but usually by an English-speaking Chinese officer who was gathered up quickly, no matter where the prisoner was taken, an officer who gave the prisoner a cigarette, a pat on the back, the extended hand of friendship, and usually a rather flowery and deliberate speech welcoming what was called the helpless tool of the imperialist Wall Street warmongers, the poor soldier, into the ranks of something called the people. Now, a lot of Americans had heard that line before. It never had much meaning before. It has a great deal of meaning when you are told that because you are not responsible for a war, because you are only a little man, only one of the masses, the people, the hapless tools of these warmongers, that because of this reason and this reason alone, we are not going to beat you. We are glad to have you here. We are happy to have been privileged to liberate you. We will treat you the best we can. We know your education has been distorted by the capitalist warmongering press and the textbooks in the schools, and all we want you to do, all in the world, not work, not dig trenches, not carry ammunition, all we want you to do is give a look to what we believe sincerely is the truth about the world and about capitalism and about what's going on to the poor people all over the earth. Well, now, the soldier, terrified as any soldier is at the point of capture, didn't hear an awful lot of this speech, but a good bit of it got through to him. And most of the soldiers, when they came back, these prisoners on repatriation, expressed the feeling that somehow, almost from the start, they had a very personal feeling toward the Chinese, not a happy or a friendly one, certainly, but they couldn't help being grateful for this treatment they were receiving. And they couldn't help noticing in themselves a tremendous sense of release and relief. Almost a reprieve from what they had expected was certain abuse and death. Well, now this feeling of gratitude, which so many men commented upon, plus the confusion of battle and of capture, which are inevitable, plus in altogether too many instances, a very poor kind of leadership, not just from officers down, but leadership among groups of individuals, with a low state of motivation and morale, these things combined effectively to prevent any semblance of order or discipline or cohesion or loyalty among the prisoners almost from the moment they were captured onward. Not after 2 years of brainwashing, not after any specialized kinds of pressure had been applied, but almost from the very start, there began what the prisoners named the dog-eat-dog period. People weren't adequately equipped sometimes. They certainly weren't adequately psychologically equipped for the kind of war they found themselves engaged in, especially after thinking they'd all be home for Christmas. And the Koreans were overtly brutal in many cases. At least they were insulting. They did nothing to try to ease the lot of the prisoner. But very soon, in the early part of 1951, the Chinese came in and took over completely from the Koreans and kicked the Koreans out in a very unceremonious and demonstrative way, making it quite clear to the Americans that they felt that Koreans were a little better than animals anyhow. They were sorry for the way the Koreans had been. They demonstrated how inferior the Koreans were in that a Chinese private who was a guard at one of the camps was empowered, given the authority, if necessary, physically to expel any commissioned Korean officer from the vicinity of a camp. They did this very openly and made it quite clear that it was a shame that this period had occurred. They're sorry they hadn't been there earlier. And they wanted all the prisoners to know that from now on they were not to be considered prisoners, they were called students, and that they were going to start something called the Chinese Lenient Policy toward America. You've all seen the think signs that IBM puts up and the other signs of that sort. They actually posted signs in some of the camps saying, be grateful for the Chinese lenient policy. And many men were, as well they might have been. This lenient policy was the real brainwashing procedure. This is when it began in earnest. And it can be best understood, this whole procedure, which I've said is educational and which I've said employs good, sound psychological principles, albeit somewhat in reverse. This whole procedure can be understood, I think, most clearly by a comparison of the different value systems present in our world and in the communist world. And no possible understanding of their methods or their aims can be achieved without an understanding of these differences. This whole procedure employed in the case of the Americans in Korea can best be understood, I think, as an attack upon character, or at least upon those elements of character that we hold to be important. Specifically, upon the elements of personal integrity that everybody knows are important, the kinds of things we always teach to our children, the things that are almost a little, they're not too chic anymore. They aren't talked about, it seems, as much as perhaps they once were. Here, personal integrity, which includes such basic, simple values, old-fashioned ones, if you will, as honor and honesty and dependability and a sense of personal loyalty between people and a sense of individual responsibility, things of this type, which we consider the elements of a man with a sound sense of personal integrity, these things depend to a considerable extent upon a reasonably well-ordered emotional life, upon emotional security or emotional maturity, which in turn in our culture depends upon one's immediate relationships. Now, this character structure in what we conceive of as an adequate and strong and individualistic, thinking for himself type of character is constructed obviously and only from those values taken from family relationships, from friendships which were actually friendships, from things learned in school when they are learned there, from Sunday schools and churches, from those institutions in our society which deal with principle instead of just techniques. Now, the communist concept of character is quite a different one from this. And I think it's important to understand, whatever you may understand about the communist from an economic or a political standpoint, this psychological viewpoint about them is as certainly as revealing as any of these others. It's important to understand that their system of values does not hold in high regard these kinds of character traits. That the things we consider as elements of personal integrity are commonly bought and sold in the communist system. It's written in their most basic writings that such things as immorality or lying, if they serve the interests of the state or the people, then of course they're entirely moral and they're to be not only condoned but encouraged. Personal loyalty has no place in the communist system. It was a common finding, it has been for years, among defected communists, that they're anxious, eager to talk about all the other communists they know, if they were really good, active communists, and if they're finally compromised. This was true of many of the Korea returnees. These people didn't seem to evidence any sense of loyalty to other prisoners. They wanted to tell us, they were almost frantic to tell us, what other prisoners had done. Not to try to lighten their own case, but just simply because this was a sort of pattern of response that they'd gotten into. Personal loyalty, honesty as such, as an absolute principle, has no place in dialectical materialism. Neither has emotional security. The emotional life is devalued seriously in the communist system. Marriages are not made in heaven. They're made in the commissar's office, if possible. And they're made, again, for the interests of things larger than the immediate family or the immediate community. They're made for the benefit of the state as a whole, wherever it's possible to get people to do this. And certainly one would never sacrifice himself on the altar of emotionalism or devotion to a wife or family when some duty to the state called him. This is really profoundly different from what we see even among our most dedicatedly patriotic people. Now, this remnant of a character structure, by our standards at least, draws what strength it has from constant adherence to, and it's not always easy, and balance upon the line as it's put out under the heading of dialectical materialism, the social and economic ideas underlying 20th century communism, and bolstered up, in this case, with some remarkable similarities to an organized religion by the writings of the prophets of this new idea, Engels and Marx and Lenin, and Stalin, I guess, has now fallen from grace, but he was still important during the POW experience, Malenkov, some of the others. Now, in order to whittle away at our character structure, or what we consider a substantial, individualistic, rugged American, something that's based on a sense of meaningful personal values, and turn it into something like this, which, of course, is ideal if you wish to tyrannize, if you wish to control large groups of people, the communists use the methods which are shown here. These were the principal methods applied to Americans in Korea. They're quite different from the diabolical tortures that we've been led to expect and some of the things that have been written in the popular press. But these are the ones that counted. These are the ones the prisoners talked about. These are the ones that were applied with such consistency and such planning that it was obvious this was the crux of the entire program for over 95% of all the Americans held captive in Korea. The first thing they did, as they have throughout the communist system, throughout the world since its inception 30 years ago, was to segregate anyone who showed what they called poisonous individualistic tendencies. I mean, among people under any kind of stress as a group, we find that somewhere between 15 and 25% become what we call emergent leaders. They simply take over. They simply are able to function under this kind of stress, and other people follow them. The Chinese, and throughout the communist system, in fact, this kind of leadership is deplored as being poisonous individualism and destructive to the state. And these people were segregated. Now, they weren't killed. They were simply put in what were called reactionary camps, where they couldn't do so much damage. They were left very much alone in the reactionary camps, and those men, by the way, got along much better than anybody else, because they were left more to their own devices. After the leaders are segregated, they started the informer system simply by encouraging what few informers invariably exist in a large group, but even more importantly than that, by using at first a system of observers composed of those Chinese who had intimate contact with the Americans from day to day. Now, these Chinese were ordinarily younger men, not always, but usually younger men, quite erudite in many ways. Many of them claimed to be, and obviously were, graduates of American universities. These people were, it appeared, students of social and political sciences. They knew a great deal about these subjects, at any rate. And they lived among the prisoners. They were quite friendly. They were always patient with them. They were always quite accepting. It was almost a psychiatric approach to these people in that they did maintain a friendly and interested but just detached attitude. They didn't get involved with the prisoners. They accepted their getting out of line to a very considerable extent. Now, when a prisoner did anything that might get him into trouble in our army, like stealing somebody's canteen cup or somebody's sleeping bag, or even swiping a turnip and eating the whole thing himself instead of sharing it, or talking about girls — this isn't allowed, not if you do it in an obscene way — or swearing back at somebody, talking back to somebody in authority. Any such offense as this was called a crime against the people, which seemed a little out of line, a little ridiculous at first. But nonetheless, it was announced as being a crime against the people, and the word was spread that such crimes against the people had been discovered because some other prisoner, which was sometimes true, had reported it to the Chinese as his civic duty, which was never true. These public-spirited informers, who were thus given more status and approval than informers are ever given in our society, be the informer the three-year-old tattletale or the grown-up informer over at Huntsville, these public-spirited informers were publicly and promptly and usually tangibly materially rewarded for their services to the people in some small way. Whereas the man informed against, and this was the crux of the success of the situation, the man informed against was not punished, at least not beyond having a heart-to-heart chat with one of the instructors who begged him, "Try to see the error of your ways, try to measure up to what we require of citizens of the new people's democracy." Well, since there was so much to gain, these little tangible material rewards which become so important to prisoners, and so little to lose and seemingly nobody getting hurt by the system of informing, it grew by leaps and bounds. And in its seemingly innocent stage got rapidly out of hand to the point where there was, as far as we can determine, ultimately at least one prisoner considered absolutely reliable as an informer and carried on Chinese lists as such in every group of four or five Americans. This was even true among the 21 non-repatriates. When Batchelor came back, he had been the leader of this group, he told me that one of the reasons that he left was because of the little internal cells of informers that had been established even in this group of 21 people, in which every cell of three or four or five men had in it at least one spy from one other group. And everybody was cross-checking on everybody else, constantly. And he finally gave up and came home. At any rate, the informer system creates very successfully the major psychological objective of all communist indoctrination, particularly where groups of people are involved, be that group the Soviet Union as a whole, or communist China, or a cell of the Communist Party here in the United States. And that objective is the production in the mind and the feeling of every individual in the group of a sense of emotional isolation, of being alone in a crowd of people, of being unsupported by those people in his immediate environment. Now, that isolation is not actually a very difficult thing to accomplish, even among people not physically isolated from one another. And this informer system was one of the most effective methods they used in creating it. Men rapidly discovered that they knew not who their friends were, and the tendency was to withdraw from everybody. You never could tell when a perfectly nice fellow, under the best possible circumstances, with no viciousness or hostility at all, might inform upon you as his civic duty. Well, this isn't entirely new, this widespread informing. We've seen it before in POW camps. We've seen it before in prisons here in the United States. We have never before among any class of Americans at any time seen anything like this, so effective and on such a magnificent scale. Well, the isolation that I spoke of was further accomplished through the mail control. Mail was never censored. A great deal of mail was delivered to the Chinese to be given to the prisoners in Korea, and very little of it was ever seen by a prisoner. Most important, the Chinese also have read what has been written about the psychological needs of prisoners of war. A great many prisoners have commented upon the intense emotional need they have for some support, some reassurance, a word or a Red Cross package sometimes. Something from home to reassure him that he's loved and wanted and that people care and haven't forgotten about him. Even soldiers in combat think that. And so it was, the prisoner never got a letter that was warm or loving or reassuring. He only got mail, which unbeknownst to him had been carefully selected and sorted to include only letters that could possibly be productive of some emotional disturbance, however mild. What the soldiers called Dear John letters, for example, were invariably delivered in Korea. Divorce subpoenas were delivered in Korea. Notices from collection companies were actually in the hands of some of the prisoners within a month from the postmark from San Francisco. Notices saying that your wife has not been paying the payments on the car and we're going to repossess if you don't get busy. Now, no prisoner welcomes that kind of news, particularly when he's living in a mud hut in North Korea. And they became, in many cases, or at least so they said, actively resentful toward the little mail they did get. And they became willing to relinquish what appeared to them to be burdensome and painful family associations. The same associations which could have provided them with the needed emotional support and could have given them a common basis for internal cohesion and some kind of concerted, resistant, survival-type activity in the camps. Another method of isolation was in the education program. It was an excellent one. Much of the material was printed by the Jefferson School of Social Studies in New York, which is a prominent member of the Attorney General's list. Now, this education never attempted to sell communism, not as such. What it did was unsell America and its institutions. It did it systematically and carefully and gently, and it did it solidly for about 2 years for most of the prisoners. They began by talking about the Korea War, about how the South Koreans had invaded North Korea, and how we'd help them, how China had to come in to protect her borders because of the known U.S. plan to invade China. And then they launched out into a rather more interesting discussion of things like the 60 big families in the United States, the DuPonts and Fords and Rockefellers and the Texas millionaires, and how these people all got their money by defrauding the government and exploiting us poor folks in the working masses. These were almost like Saturday Evening Post articles up to a certain point until the twist was finally put in, and they showed how Andrew Carnegie, in spite of all the libraries that he helped to build, had killed off innocent settlers during the westward expansion of the railroads, or his agents had. They talked about things like sweatshops and child labor, about murdering plant police hired by every big business to kill off innocent labor union organizers. They taught a version of American history which isn't taught in most public schools in America today, and taught only the negative aspects, only the side that these boys, many of them, had never heard. And they didn't use communist literature for this. They used Dos Passos and Steinbeck and Hemingway. They even went back and used Charles Dickens to show how children can be exploited by evil capitalists. And they taught that these things were not only current events in much of the capitalist Western world, but were the lifeblood of our system. Well, this program went on, as I say, for 2 years in 12 carefully defined phases. Each phase was introduced by lectures lasting, as communist lectures usually do, 6 and 7 hours at a stretch. These lectures were attended mostly outdoors and mostly in a standing position. This way nobody went to sleep. After the lecture, they employed the best graduate teaching methods, the discussion group and seminar. Men were divided into groups of 12 to 15 and required each man to discuss the material so repetitiously and clearly brought out in the lecture that morning. Now, it wasn't required that you agree with what had been taught. It was only required that you discuss it. And there wasn't any punishment for not discussing. It was a very simple procedure. If you didn't discuss, then the other men in the discussion group didn't get to go to supper until you did. And so the pressure from other prisoners was actually more than from the Chinese to get men to participate in this most telling and most effective of all teaching methods. Well, they also had an athletic program. They know enough not to make people sit in class all day. They had an inter-camp Olympics, finally. A real Olympic Games with the 12 camps competing against one another. This was all worked up to using the usual little tricks and twists. You could play baseball if you wanted to, if you got enough people together. The only requirement was that there be a short political rally before the baseball game, during which you marched around the field carrying banners and shouting slogans and singing old-fashioned folk songs like the Internationale, and then you got to play baseball. And after the baseball game, you then had another brief rousing yell for the people, and back you went to studying. There was a little theater group in several camps that could put on plays and were freely allowed to do so, just as long as the plays vilified the evils of capitalist imperialism and glorified the new people's democracies. There were art classes in many of the camps, just as long as your artwork was not decadent capitalistic art, which means as long as you didn't draw pictures of girls. If you drew pictures showing the workers and the progress in the workers' societies, or could somehow tell a political message about that warmonger Harry S. Truman that was sitting in Washington, a lot of cartoons were produced about this by prisoners. If you could do that, you could draw. Otherwise, you stayed in class. They had camp newspapers in most camps. Unsolicited articles, if published, received as much as 2 whole ready-made cigarettes in payments. In camp number 5... where 600 Americans were guarded by approximately 6 men, they received on the average 800 unsolicited articles for the camp newspaper per month. These articles are fantastic. I've seen innumerable ones. They are still appearing in the China Monthly Review, the Shanghai Daily News, the China People's World, the New York Daily Worker, and they include such obvious falsehoods. And here, prisoners thought they were being a little tricky with the Chinese. They thought they were being so obviously liars in their articles that nobody believed them. Obvious falsehoods as, I wish to thank the members of the Chinese People's Republic for having taught me to read and write English, because in my community, members of the working class are not permitted to do this. Now, these articles are read by millions of people in the world who have no other sources of information. And they're signed and sworn to, so to speak, by Americans. They got an enormous quantity of such material. One final device, which is the most psychiatric type device that they used, increased the sense of isolation by making everybody afraid of everybody else. This is the process called self-criticism. And it's almost identical in its method and its organization to group psychotherapy. Here, each man gets up in his turn, there's no particular pressure put on him to do this, and exposes himself in an introspective way, discussing his shortcomings, his failures to measure up to the almost impossibly high stated moral and ethical standards required of people in the new people's democracies. He talks about the selfishness that he's felt, about some of the poor attitudes that his father taught him because he was an unsuspecting capitalist at heart. Talks about things he's done in the camps that weren't right, things that maybe nobody saw him do, but somebody might have. And it's much better to do a self-criticism about it than have somebody charge you with it publicly. And at first, everybody thought this was a kind of a joke. If this is what the Chinese want, fine, we'll have a self-criticism meeting if they feed us a little better. But of course, what happened very rapidly, as inevitably must in such a situation, One rapidly runs out of superficialities. One rapidly begins talking about things that really have some meaning. Somebody brings up highly charged emotional, political, or religious issues. And these things get discussed, and feelings flare up. And the men in the discussion group become strangers, because each man feels, with each succeeding discussion period, with each succeeding self-criticism, that he becomes a little more naked and a little more vulnerable psychologically and emotionally to the other people there. The prisoners describe from this situation an increasing sense of guilt over what they couldn't put their fingers on, but guilt nonetheless. An increasing, sometimes almost intolerable sense of anxiety. And the interesting thing about this process, which you may remember Mr. Molotov engaged in publicly a few weeks ago, interesting thing about this process is that every Chinese soldier that we captured on the front lines told us that in his ordinary routine duties as a rifleman for the Chinese People's Forces in Korea, every day, in addition to working on his bunker and getting his chow and cleaning his weapon, he had at least an hour of formal political indoctrination and an hour of self-criticism. Every day. Now, this procedure is being used on approximately a third of the Earth's total population, at least those people in that third who are in the military age group and in the formal education school age group. It's being done systematically and intensively. When we got through looking at this, we kind of shuddered, wondering what would have been the case if the 129,000 Americans who were captured in World War II instead of 4,000 in Korea had been subjected to 3 or 4 years of this very intensive and very effective education. This education that I've described, with its self-criticism, its group psychotherapy, its male control, its education, this is brainwashing. It is not significantly more than this. I'd like to emphasize for a moment the things it doesn't include. This is necessary, certainly, because of the fact that those people who write articles for certain types of magazines, some of which have rather wide circulation, and certain kinds of newspapers, have, in an understandable way, emphasized and dramatized those rare instances in which a man was actually physically mistreated. And it seems to be almost the unanimous opinion of the public at large that this is the way brainwashing is done. And the communists, we give them little credit if we think this. They're really not that stupid. They didn't use burning bamboo splinters under people's fingernails. They didn't use narcotics, in spite of the fact that we know they play a role in the international narcotic trade. This is not a method of indoctrination. In fact, there was some marijuana smoked in Korea. One recent returnee who refused repatriation at first and spent a couple of years in the people's paradise and then just came home told us as he came home that the reason he did all these things was that they had me on marijuana. Which, if true, is probably the first case of true addiction to marijuana on record. There was marijuana smoked in Korea, as I say. It was smoked, it was cultivated, it was sold by exactly the same juvenile delinquent-type element, the duck-tailed haircut switchblade knife set that grows it or peddles it or smokes it here in the United States. And the communists made political hay out of just this. They said, look among you for examples of typical hopeless capitalist decadence, the peddling by your own fellow prisoners of this diabolical drug. Well, they didn't use magic either. And by magic, I want emphatically to include the Pavlovian conditioned reflex, which most Americans seem to think is a kind of magic. And Pavlov, who wasn't a communist, as I understand it, in describing his original experiments in which he demonstrated the conditioned reflex type of learning, clearly emphasized the fact that this applies to simple physiological reflexes much more than to anything else that he could determine. And furthermore, he pointed out quite clearly in his original reports how if you ring the bell too often, the dog won't salivate. Or if you bring another dog in the room, he won't salivate. Or if he's not hungry, he won't salivate. And yet this process has been widely acclaimed as the reason why communist indoctrination and brainwashing, and the communists themselves have claimed this, is so effective and so irresistible to human beings, who implicitly are no better than Pavlov's dogs in this respect. But this procedure, which is inadequate at best for teaching complicated things to dogs, is totally inadequate to teach a complex esoteric philosophy like dialectical materialism to human beings. The prisoners, it now appears, lived in this very strange kind of environment, which was a sort of Charles Dickens-style nightmare, with overtones of George Orwell's 1984, a kind of a communist-style prep school atmosphere, characterized by tongue-in-the-cheek kindness, constant talk about virtue, and interestingly enough, this became quite attractive to many prisoners. The talk about morality and ethics and virtue. Constant study and discussions and classes, which lasted on many occasions all day and even sometimes all night. Heart-to-heart chats with the instructors, who are always pleasant and friendly and kind. And bully boys and teachers' pets among the students themselves who flouted their pathetic rewards of candy and cigarettes. All of this was evidently too confusing and too erratic for a great many of these young Americans, equipped as they were with knowledge and convictions about their country, and equipped as they were with this false mythology about what happens in communist captivity. It was too much for these people to cope with entirely successfully. Now, for the soldiers subjected to this, it didn't make him a communist. That was quite clear. It did, however, weaken his convictions as a convinced and dedicated American, if he were one to begin with. It extracted from him militarily everything that he knew with great ease. It raised doubts and real confusion in his mind about himself and about his country, and it turned him into what is undoubtedly the most passive, submissive, docile, non-aggressive, uniformed American we have ever before had an opportunity to study. A man who, for example, rarely even tried to run away. And in spite of a recent TV broadcast, not one American ever succeeded in an engineered escape from an established POW camp on the very small peninsula of Korea. Never organized individually or in groups any effective form of resistance. Learned nothing in more than 3 years of intimate contact with the Chinese, learned nothing of tactical or strategic interest to the United States, made no effort to do so. And in a great many instances, manifested a disease that the prisoners themselves named, a disease called give-up-itis. And the only thing comparable to it is marasmus in the newborn. In these cases, in which men were seen by physicians in many cases, the man would simply refuse to eat. He would tell people to leave him alone. He wasn't interested in doing anything or talking to anybody. If they wanted his food, go ahead and take it. He would pull his blanket over his head and in 48 hours would be dead. And there was no evidence in these cases of any serious physical disorder. This was not a form of psychosis or major hysteria. These men, if pushed a little bit, if somebody proved to them that they were loved by insisting that they eat, even slapping them around if necessary, those survived. If you didn't bother with them, they died, and they died very rapidly. Well, now, the results of the pressures which the communists applied to Americans in Korea appear to have been everything that the enemy could possibly desire, short of conversion to communism of those people in their hands. The conversion rate was low, clearly because this was not an objective of the Chinese. They made no attempt to convert people in the sense of wanting to proselytize for converts who would go to Peking or go to Moscow, except at the last minute, as a face-saving device, they did solicit the 21 who stayed back and very carefully selected those. What was accomplished was widespread collaboration on a scale we've never before seen. In addition to this, of course, they collected the most fabulous bonanza of believable, expert, psychological warfare material, propaganda, that they have ever turned loose on the world. The real beginning of the current fake peace offensive and the Geneva look. Now, the behavior of a great many Americans in Korea, not the few who are being court-martialed, and I specifically exclude those few men who occur in any war, in any large group of men, not those, but the behavior of a great many of the others, about a third, appears to have fallen far short of the most basic historic standards of character and honor and loyalty and personal integrity. Now, this behavior involved colonels as well as privates, older people as well as young, this side of the tracks as well as the other side. It involved people from divorced parents and people from intact families. No such correlations so far have proven really significant. It appears, this behavior and the scale upon which it occurred, short of being actual crimes against other men of brutality or even murder, as some of the men did commit, short of that, the behavior of large numbers of Americans in Korea appears to be a serious and a valid indictment of at least certain aspects of our American character and of the social and the political and the military education of our people. Now, should this behavior again occur, particularly in a general war, and particularly a war involving the North American continent physically, then the effect from the standpoint of the collection of military intelligence alone can be disastrous. The new code of conduct that the president has outlined was derived directly from the experiences of the Korea War. It points out clearly and precisely what the major defects were that were discovered. If you examine this code, in some ways it seems startling that we find it necessary at this point to outline things which we assume Americans know. For example, the new code makes such an obvious statement as the fact that if you are captured by an enemy, don't do anything or say anything to hurt your fellow American prisoners. Now, that's a crime even if you're not a prisoner. And yet now it becomes necessary to say this in a code to American soldiers. The code goes on to say, if you're captured by an enemy of the United States, don't do anything or say anything to hurt the United States of America. And yet every man who puts on this uniform, as you know, swears an oath, not just not to hurt it, but to support it and defend it. And yet a great many prisoners said, well, gee, I thought when I became a prisoner, all that sort of thing was over. And in effect, they abandoned their responsibilities not only as soldiers, but even as citizens. Or at least this is what they said. The code goes on to make a commentary about leadership in one short sentence, which is one of the most telling blows at the quality of leadership among us. And I don't mean the leadership of infantry divisions. I mean leadership of the kind that emerges and is taught in school and in the Boy Scouts and in Sunday school. When the code finds it necessary to make the most obvious comment upon leadership that could possibly be made, when it says, if you are captured and you're the senior man, take command. And if you're not the senior man, for heaven's sakes, obey the man who is in command. Now, this was a fatal mistake made by a number of prisoners. A prisoner, maybe a private or a PFC, would start drinking rice paddy water, which is fertilized with human excreta and is nothing more than a solution of pathogenic bacteria. And his sergeant or his lieutenant or a colonel would walk up to him, for that matter, and say, son, don't drink that water. You've been told that since you left the United States. You know it'll make you sick. It can kill you. And the soldier would finish drinking his water, and he'd look up at the colonel or the sergeant or the lieutenant, and he'd say, Buster, you just run along. You're nothing but a damn prisoner like me. And men died because they made this mistake, who on a wide scale in Korea made such mistakes as this. I don't mean to emphasize only the negative, although, of course, it's the negative that creates our problem. This kind of behavior involved approximately a third of the surviving Americans. It's important, however, to realize that only 62% of the Americans who were captured survived. Of that 62%, one-third became something called progressives, which by a communist definition, by the communist definition, in the POW camps was a man who actively collaborated, was an active and reliable informer, or who assisted in the indoctrination of other Americans. One out of three Americans did this. This, we believe, should be the occasion for the most searching and stringent self-examination by all Americans, and particularly by those who raise and who teach the children who ultimately defend this country. Now, we in the Army don't pretend to have the solutions to these new and very important problems of prisoner behavior. Important mainly because they're symptomatic of things others have commented upon within our own society. The abandonment of principle, the degradation of authority. Now, we do think there are some indications of definite countermeasures which emerge so clearly from the data at hand as to make some comment upon them appropriate. In spite of the new code of conduct and a new intensified training program for men in the service emphasizing what communism is and what democracy is, because so many soldiers came back and said, you know, they told us things about this system of ours, and we couldn't say they were wrong because we didn't know. Nobody ever told us. Who's this habeas corpus they talk about? The only people that knew about habeas corpus were the juvenile delinquents who'd been arrested and who'd used it. And it's obvious that in spite of all these new measures to equip soldiers, it's certainly obvious to anybody who's raised or taught children that character development and guidance, and this was the crux of the difference between those who survived and resisted actively, magnificently in many cases, and those who did not. And that character development and guidance in an old-fashioned sense, in just a very simple, basic kind of set of principles. This sort of thing begins with the preschool child, not with the 18-year-old. It begins in the cradle and at parents' knees. And I don't think many psychiatrists necessarily agree, but even occasionally across parents' knees. And this kind of character education must be carefully nurtured throughout the educational process. There's a severe limitation upon the ability of the armed forces or any institution in society to change significantly basic character traits after adolescence, which is when we get our soldiers. Likewise, a firm education in the fundamentals of this specific democracy, its strengths, its tremendous achievements, as well as its defects, where they've existed and been corrected, these things are undertakings of primary importance for parents and for the schools, not for the military. However, so long as the public educational system continues to be demonstrably remiss in providing enormous numbers of our soldiers with these facts, then we must, and we are trying desperately to augment and supplement the education of every American soldier, commissioned officer included. This is not to suggest that every private soldier has to have a college-level education to withstand the communist diatribe. Quite the contrary. The communist methods, their approach to the prisoners, the areas in which they had the greatest success, and the areas of their failures, all demonstrate quite clearly that merely a simple and a concrete, but an honest, lived-out presentation of basic character traits, something to believe in, standards to live by, and some of these educational facts that I've mentioned would be more than sufficient to arm, as it has in the past, the average American high school student against any assault upon this system. It's tragically clear that our system, as fine as it is, perhaps the best on earth, is still failing miserably in getting across these fundamentals, not fundamentals of being a just, well-adjusted, comfortable adult, but fundamentals of survival in a tense and a troubled international society. This, we believe, needs to be publicized and talked about. And since the armed forces were the proving ground, so to speak, upon which these failures were so clearly and so tragically demonstrated, it would appear that it is our duty to you, our employers, to do so. Now, the Army's internal task, the armed forces' internal task, is equally clear, and I mention it only to point out that it is your Army and your Navy, and its excellence or lack of it depends in very large measure upon the material you send it and upon your support and concern with it, your thoughts about it. It became clear in Korea, for example, or it seemed to be to many of us, that no so-called democratized and liberalized, but basically undisciplined army could possibly survive when the going got really rough, particularly an army which seemed at times to be designed to please mothers, boys, and boys' mothers. The military forces to survive and to defend you must become military organizations, which means they have to be tightly organized, adequately trained, and intensely disciplined. And by discipline, I don't mean punishment. I don't mean the beating of innocent children, and I don't mean the arbitrary imposition upon some helpless drafted private of something totally unreasonable by a mean old sergeant. This isn't discipline. Discipline, even in the dictionary, consists of internalized values of self-regulation, of a set of standards and a system of values which actually
function as guides for behavior, and without which nobody achieves maturity and nobody achieves any degree of success in his marriage or his business or his profession or face-to-face with a communist dialectician. It seems that in the frantic rush that we've made for a better push-button army, for bigger and better guided missiles, for bigger and better machines of all kinds and electronic calculators to do our thinking for us, that we've neglected the basic primary aim and objective of the military, which is no different now from what it was in Valley Forge, which is the construction of adequate men to run these machines and to defend us. I would like to read for you in conclusion a statement which was written by General Lemuel C. Shepard, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, in relation to this specific problem as he summed it up. When I first read this, it sounded like simply a generalization, a thing to put at the end of a document. But if one thinks about it a little bit, it is immediately and intensely pertinent to this problem. And the problem defies less generalization than this. It becomes a problem for each and every individual to undertake the best he can with the people with whom he works and certainly with the people he raises or teaches. General Shepard said this: in the struggle against communism, the war is no longer over when men are forced to yield. The prisoner of war stockade is only an extension of the battlefield, where they must be taught to carry on an unequal struggle with the only weapons remaining to them: faith and courage. We do not issue these weapons in any military supply room. The problem will not be solved by a magic formula. The only approach lies in an awakening of the consciousness of the nation and of the individual to the need for a sense of conviction and dedication to our cause, which exceeds that shown by our enemies toward their own.
Major Mayor, can any correlation be made between the behavior of prisoners who had Boy Scout training and those who had not?
I can't give you a specific mathematical correlation. We had people who resisted. Among the resistors, and this is the group that really now needs the most intensive research, is those who resisted. Up until now, of course, we focused our attention on this rather large group who didn't resist in any active sense. It was our impression, talking to those who did, that they did so on the basis often of personalized values of the kind, certainly, that are taught intensively in the Boy Scouts. Occasionally a man would tell us, for example, that he resisted on the basis of certain religious principles. This didn't seem to be related to any specific church group, and it certainly wasn't religious principles of the kind that we call foxhole religion, not the fellow who gets converted when the things start to go off. But among people within whose families this had been a vital, active part of living, these people were sometimes defended by this set of ideas. As far as making a specific mathematical correlation, this remains to be done.
Were officers and enlisted men separated? Did they get the same sort of treatment, and was the result similar?
Were officers and enlisted men segregated? Did they get the same treatment, and was the response similar? At first, they were not segregated. At first, it was the typical confusion, and for several months, they were among the prisoners. They were rather ineffective, I think largely because they encountered wholly unexpected, massive failure to pay any attention to them at all, which many of them found themselves incapable of handling. It was on too big a scale. They were then segregated into a camp, number two. In this camp, there was not nearly as much indoctrination given as there was to the enlisted men. Now, there was a very interesting point involved here. Some of the prisoners got to be such good friends with the Chinese and so active in the indoctrination program that they actually lived in camp headquarters with the Chinese. These people weren't at all secretive about it when they came back. They talked about it very freely. In fact, some of them felt that they'd done the right thing, that if we thought it was wrong, then it was an error in judgment, but they hadn't meant to do anything wrong. But they expressed certain things that the Chinese had told them. For example, that any American who was a commissioned officer was, of course, a pretty crystallized product of our capitalistic society. Now, they never said that they couldn't do anything with such people, but they did say specifically they thought it would take 5 or 6 years, and that therefore, while they would give them a certain amount of indoctrination, they knew they wouldn't get very far, and that's one of the reasons they kept them apart. The same with career soldiers, people who had been in the military a long time. The same with anybody. You know, we used to talk up on the front lines about what to tell them if you're captured. Do you tell them that you're a member of the proletariat, or do you tell them you're an out-and-out capitalist? Well, the right answer was to tell them you were a capitalist, because a man would, during an interrogation, would say, "No, sir, I drive a Cadillac and my old man drives a Cadillac. And I intend to go home to that Cadillac. And I don't have anything to do with your system." They felt he was just hopeless. He was just completely stupid. You couldn't do anything with this kind of a man. Now, this was the general attitude toward officers. That given 5 or 6 years, or given communist China, where the individual there has no logical anticipation of ever being released, then they can handle such people. But not the American officers. They left them very much more alone than they did the others. Interestingly enough, they did, at times, suffer some serious difficulties in that camp. There was one time when there were no more than three officers. There was no group of larger than three officers who would speak to each other. They were all, there had been enough infiltration, enough informing, enough manipulation of the group that even they became overwhelmingly suspicious of one another. But to a certain extent, they even got through to these people. But they didn't communicate the ideas to them that they did to some of the enlisted troops who had much more intensive education. Ideas like, the commonest single thought that was expressed by prisoners coming back was something like this. They would say, two thoughts. One, I don't like the communists, but I have to admit they treated us the best they could. Which was quite an admission coming from the prison. This we don't anticipate at all. And the second idea that was commonly expressed was, I'm not a communist. I don't agree with their system at all. I don't think it'd work in the U.S. anyway because we're so well off here. But I'll tell you, Doc, it's a wonderful thing for China. And it'd be a great thing for India and for those other countries where these masses of people have been exploited for so long. Well, that's a hair-raising idea. And they put it out blithely. People, even reactionaries, said this sometimes.
What about the treatment given to General Dean, Major Mayor?
General Dean was given a private house to live in. Not much of a house, but it was a private quarter to live in. Because, admittedly, and the Chinese explained this to him in great detail, they felt that a general officer deserved a private quarters, that he wasn't to be quartered with ordinary prisoners. Inadvertently, this was, and I think it was largely inadvertent, this turned out for General Dean to be one of the most severe punishments and tortures that could possibly be, because they never bothered to give him a pencil or a piece of paper or anything to read. And after a couple of years of this, you get fairly bored.
Weren't the prisoners ever tortured or given cruel treatment?
These things are the kinds of things that have been most emphasized in reporting the experiences of the prisoners. Sometimes a man, for example, would be required to stand at attention. Now, we first got the idea they'd been required to stand at attention for 4 days, at a stretch. It then turned out that some of them had been required to stand at attention for, a maximum of 3 or 4 hours, which is hard to do. There's no question about that. This is entirely in line with the provisions of the Geneva Convention. This is how Korean and Chinese soldiers are given company punishment type of discipline. Sitting on the edge of the chair is not only done in Korean POW camps, it's done in schools in Japan and Korea as an ordinary method of demanding and getting respect and attention from students. A great deal was made of this. On top of physical and emotional deprivation, this sort of thing can be magnified, as you know, to the point where it's seemingly intolerable. But as far as being calculated torture and punishment, no. All this talk we heard at first about people being put in a hole, you know, there was all that. This hole, the holes that they talked about, I had one in a hospital company that I was operating in Korea, a hole. We didn't use it for that purpose. It was there, as it had been in other Korean villages, the fruit cellar, where the wealthy landowner in that village dug a large place in the ground, big enough to put these huge jars of grain that they for storage. Now, prisoners, when they really got obstreperous, especially if they talked back and got really nasty or threatening with the Chinese, were often made to sit in one of these places and think over the error of their ways until they were ready to come out and say they were sorry. It was almost infantile, the method that they used. Now, there were more severe examples than that. There were a couple of men who were put in holes and somebody banged on the top of the hole every time they went by with a stick, just like in a fraternity initiation. After a couple of days, that can get to the point where the man is pretty frantic. But even these things, which did happen on occasion, happened so rarely to so small a number of men, and will happen in at least this degree, to a certain extent under the jurisdiction of any holding power on earth, practically. This we can do nothing about, and this doesn't constitute our major problem. Men never claimed that they gave in for reasons like that, ever. In fact, the best examples of resistance were in the face of even worse things than that. One Air Force officer stood up on 12 separate occasions after digging his own grave, stood before a firing squad while they fired at him with empty chambers. He said that it wasn't until a fourth or fifth time that he was really sure they weren't going to do it. How that man ever got to the fourth or fifth time, none of us know. But this is in line with what was reported, for example, about Stead Air Force Base. The recent flap in Newsweek and then in Time and Life about how the Air Force is torturing Americans. And they had a picture of a poor, haggard American hanging on a fence and a diabolical torture box. Well, I've talked to several hundred Air Force people who've been through that school, and I have yet to find a man who doesn't say in so many words, this is the finest experience I ever had in my life. It's a survival school. One of the smallest parts of it was a demonstration of interrogation methods. They tried to dramatize it, and, well, the Air Force uses a lot of imagination sometimes, and the Air Force doesn't intend to try to inoculate, immunize people against torture by giving them small doses of torture. Nobody thinks that that works. But that was the way it was reported, and many people got righteously and rightly indignant about what the dickens we were doing to their son. But that's been the way so much of this has come up. General Dean had a tougher time than most people because he was in solitary. But I don't think that this was calculated to destroy General Dean at all. And he has said so himself, too, repeatedly.
How successful were we in indoctrinating the Chinese prisoners that we held?
Again, I should reiterate the fact that what I say here is not necessarily the policy of the Department of Defense or the Department of the Army. The Geneva Convention provides that any holding power may indoctrinate and re-educate or attempt to do so any prisoners of war in their power. We do this. So does every holding power on earth, if they have the time and the personnel to do so. We, however, faced in the Chinese communists one of the most fantastic behind-the-lines armies that's ever been known. These people were evidently trained before they were ever captured, that if captured, you will take command, and you will organize this kind of a group, and you will put down resistance from within your group, and you will make sure nobody collaborates. And if they try to indoctrinate you, start singing our song, and start marching, and start demonstrations. And this is exactly what they did. And our success indoctrinating Chinese with our ideas, in my opinion, was nil. The people who came over to our side came over for very largely personal reasons. who felt that their chances with Chiang Kai-shek were better than their chances going back to communist China. I don't think we had any degree of success. It was all we could do to keep them on the island.
Does the education and training of the communist youth, then, better prepare them for the ordeal of internment?
I think it shows up. I think the comparison between the way their prisoners behave and the way ours behaved is a demonstration of this. It's a terrible mistake to think that these people, the communists, are insincere, or that they're just doing this because they're mean, or because there are a bunch of opportunists who think they're getting ahead. These people convinced the Americans in POW camp that they were sincere, and they believed what they're doing. And they kept talking about the same kind of basic character traits that we talk about honesty, and about not talking about sex, and about trying to think of real values in life, and about obedience, and obedience to a higher principle. But for many people, this was the first time anybody ever got through to them with these ideas. And I think that communist home training, at least judging by the behavior, by the results of what we see in the well-disciplined communist army, they're not the fabulous, irresistible armies that some people think, but they're fairly good. And they certainly were adequately trained in many cases and magnificently disciplined. And this doesn't start in the army. This starts in their system, unquestionably, in the grade school, where the child is taught at this level his primary and fundamental loyalties. And we've seen innumerable examples of where these have worked to the detriment of his family loyalties. Now, we can advocate the same kind of principle in line with the values we hold dear. But these have got to be taught. Your children, I think, in many cases, are expected to sort of get it by osmosis, and they don't. They get it by precept and by being told and by having the limits set, by having the crucial people in their environment define for them what they believe values to be. We see many kids in the armed forces who, after all, are just a relatively random sample of healthy Americans who aren't bad kids at all. They just don't believe in anything. They work on a pragmatic philosophy which says if you can get away with it, it's all right. That's the proof.
If, in indoctrinating with communism, so much depends upon teaching the young, why were the communists so successful in re-educating the adult Chinese?
The best explanations of this that I have ever heard from Chinese is the fact that while China isn't well off, they're better off than they were before. That, frankly, more people at least can talk. Before, they couldn't talk at all. Now they have to talk the communist line, but at least they can talk. At least now they feel that they're participating. Many of them have reached the bitter conclusion that this was a sham and a delusion already. But still, for many of the peasants in China who suffered under the Kuomintang and some of the abuses under that system and under individuals in it, undoubtedly have felt that this is an improvement, that it's at least a step. And it was sold largely in China, of course, originally on the same basis that they tried to sell it to us, that this was just an agrarian reform kind of thing. This wasn't communism. And once you get to a certain point where the natural leaders, the 15 to 25% who lead, plus those who held the power and the wealth and the ability to communicate, once you've exterminated those people, you can do a great deal, even though you're working with adults. You can do a great deal with the peasants and the other people, many of whom were exploited. It is true, a capitalist power in this world has fought two wars against China to force them to buy opium within the last 125 years. The Chinese have long memories. This is one of the things the Chinese have taught in their schools and let people know about and brought out, how they were bled of real materials and real wealth in return for opium. Well, this is why so many prisoners came back and said, frankly, it's a wonderful thing for China. It wouldn't work in the U.S., but it has helped China, they say. They've got more schools, and more people are eating. There aren't any beggars. You see? So it's a step.
How did the troops of other United Nations forces behave in the POW camps? such as the Turks, for example.
There were 400 Turks captured, and 400 Turks came back. And to capture a Turk, he's just about got to be wounded, or you can't catch him. The Turks are awfully good soldiers. They really are. These were kids. They weren't old, tough, professional soldiers. They were youngsters, many of them. Many of them had just been a little too young to get into World War II and felt that here was their chance to be in the army a little bit. Turkey has a tradition of militant activities and a strong fighting arm. But these Turks, naturally, we examined them quite closely. We wanted to know why it was that they not only came back, but they came back in reasonably good shape. The day after the bulk of the Turks were repatriated, they called out almost every MP in the camp in Tokyo in which they were being held to control 400 stark naked, screaming, laughing, jolly Turks who were swimming in the camp pool outside the camp chapel during Sunday service. These people were not exactly beat down, starved individuals. We asked them why. It turned out they had the same diet, the same conditions of captivity. The same attempts were made to indoctrinate them. They even got members of Turkish minorities. Some of the Soviet republics in the Soviet Union are entirely Turkish, actually, but are well within the Soviet Union. They had members of these Turkish minorities in Soviet Russia to indoctrinate the Turks. And they came in and they read them all the stuff, and the Turks stood at attention. They're very polite and very good soldiers, and they saluted the officers and the indoctrinators. They never said a word. They just stood. And not only that, but the crux of their survival was this. A great many Americans died because when a man got too sick to eat, somebody quite naturally figured that, well, he wouldn't be needing his food anymore anyway, and I need it, so I'll maybe take a little. Men got thrown out of huts when they got too sick because they were personally offensive. And with 40 men in a small hut, one man with diarrhea can sort of upset the whole thing. Still, it's a form of murder to throw them out. One man was convicted of this not too long ago. Now, this happened, unfortunately, more times, we think, than we can put our finger on. Very difficult to get information about it. But among the Turks, details were assigned when a man got sick. A group of six or eight men was assigned to the sick man. They took off his clothes. They bathed him. They slept around him closely to keep him warm if he were cold. They went out and gathered roots and herbs and grasses, anything they could to supplement the diet, stuff they'd never seen before, but they got it. And they boiled it up for soup, and they fed it to these people. And essentially, in addition to what physical support they got, these men got the crucial emotional support that is so desperately needed. The sense of guilt and the depression that overtakes the POW is enormous, and many of them say is their principal problem. The give-up-itis type of thing wasn't seen among Turks because when a Turk got sick, he was constantly reassured by the presence and the activities of a group of other Turks that, by golly, they were going to take care of him. Nothing would happen to him. We see this in some of our better units, some of our better identified, better motivated units, the same kind of feeling. And there was one other thing among the Turks. Remember I said when the colonel would walk up to the private and say, "Don't drink that water," and the private would say, "You run along." Among the Turks, there was a major captured with this 400 Turks. And this major took command, naturally, and he exercised the same command that the Turkish general exercised over the Turkish brigade, which was in Korea. Absolute, really absolute. He assigned the details, set up the squads, the companies, everything. Gave all the orders, did all the communicating with the enemy. Anybody that wanted anything done or to bring anything to the enemy's attention went to him. So naturally, the Chinese, recognizing here a poisonous individualistic reactionary, segregated him. So the sergeant, there was a lieutenant who took over, and they segregated him because he was also a reactionary. And then a sergeant took over with exactly the same precise military discipline that they exercised in Japan and on our side of the line. And so they segregated the sergeant. And finally, they had nothing but privates in the Turkish camp, all privates. And so the senior private took command. Well, they segregated him, and it went on down the line like this, and the Chinese would come in, and they'd say, "Now, look, you people can't do this. This one here is going to be the leader of this outfit, and you're going to follow his direction." And the Turks, always polite, would salute, and they would say, "Yes, sir. If he's to be the leader, then he's the leader. But we're still going to listen to this one over here." And they kept segregating Turks, ultimately, until all the Turks were back together again. Now, there were two Turks in the whole course of captivity who gave in to any degree whatever, and all they did was very interesting. They just got them to read a document. It wasn't even a political document. But they said, you two are Turks, you read it to the rest of the people. We've got to have it read. So these two Turks read it. And every single other Turk said, there are two Turks who aren't going to make it on the ship. And they didn't, as far as I know. These people, from that moment on, were not spoken to by another Turk. They were not taken care of. They were just completely out. And when we asked these Turks why they did this, how much military training they'd had, they hadn't had significantly different preparation than our people had. And their explanation was a very simple one. Why did you behave this way? How did you resist? How did you manage? And we had expert Turkish-speaking interrogators. And the answer was always the same. I'm a Turk. Now, there were 253 U.S. Marines captured, ground troops. Not a one of these was a progressive. We asked these people why they resisted, why they weren't in with the progressives. And the answer was always, after sort of a vacant stare, I'm a Marine. This is enough. If it carries with it connotations, which maybe the man can't verbalize, but which he believes. We see Army units that are the same way.
The last question, Major Mayor. You mentioned we had a better weapon. What is our better weapon?
We've attempted to revise and become very specific in our troop information program about the nature of the communist machine and methods and ideology and intentions. We've become more specific about the American democracy. It's appalling how little Americans know about the American democracy. Many soldiers, well, a fair number of soldiers have to be taught a little more reading and writing than they know when they come in the Army. And a much larger percentage than that have never had any education about America aside from what they managed to inadvertently hear during a civics class in the seventh grade. And so we have to teach them. And when I say we have a better weapon, we do. Our set of ideas, clearly and honestly presented, and our history and our achievements, including all the defects and the failures where they've occurred, set up side by side with an equally honest presentation of communism, sells itself so easily on its merits that there's no problem involved. Our problem is one of communication. Of communication not only of the elements of our system, but the feelings that have gone into it. And some people call this flag waving, and maybe it is flag waving to a certain extent. I'm not sure flag waving is sinful. It's certainly not impossible to be intensely loyal to your own family and yet be a loyal member of your community or your nation. And similarly, it's possible to be an intensely loyal and patriotic American and still be a good citizen of the world and still concerned with other people in the world. But this we don't communicate to people. If you're patriotic, you're a flag waver, or it's embarrassing. Kids are often embarrassed by talk about this kind of value. And so are some of us. And this is something that can be remedied only on a unitary level, only by individuals, talking to individuals. And the thing is that the communists do this. They're terribly sincere about it and terribly intense. This program wasn't new at all. It wasn't designed for America. It is used every day in the communist social system. We know of over 1,400 new schools of social and political science in the Soviet Union established between 1945 and 1950. 1,400 college-level institutions of social and political science. Where do you think they get all the political indoctrinators that are with the Chinese Army and with the Russian Army? These are not soldiers. These are political instructors. These people are working at it, and they're planning not for next year's budgetary appropriation. They plan 7 years and 10 years and 20 years in advance. This became very clear. Well, we can't match this just because you and I know we've got the best system. We're bringing up a whole generation of people who are going to have to defend this system, one way or the other, on a battlefield or in selling our ideas elsewhere. That's what I mean by a better weapon.
If this recording has been informative and interesting, and you wish to obtain copies to play to other civic groups, contact your nearest Air Force Reserve Squadron Liaison NCO or the Information Services Officer, Oklahoma City Air Reserve Center, Will Rogers Field in Oklahoma City. Recommended reading lists are available to familiarize you with the communistic
psychological warfare program. Much information can also be furnished about the United States' own efforts in this war of the minds for mankind.